right by.
This is the Arrakis 12,000 system board, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Le Rendezvous de la Francophonie is back for its 27th year. My name is Catherine Fisher, and I interviewed 8 Canadians for the Franco podcast. In this episode, I spoke with Laura Yaros, a certified translator, a journalist, and a former community radio host in Montreal. Here's our conversation.
So, Laura, you became a certified translator almost 40 years ago. What inspired you to do this work, and how has that work changed over time?
I didn't start out wanting to be a translator. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. At first, I thought maybe I'd want to become a lawyer, you know, an attorney. And I would go to McGill Law School because I was going to be studying at McGill. But I remember when I was at McGill in my first years, you know, the undergraduate stuff, there was a job fair. And I went to this job fair and they had some lawyer giving a little talk about, you know, law school and being a lawyer and all this. I remember I was very young. I was like 18, 19, and it was like, and I remember he was sitting there and he was very like cynical and kind of unfriendly and just, I don't know, and kind of bitter. You know, he was talking about law school and how it was very competitive and people would undercut each other, and they often would take more people because they knew they would be ending up kicking people out eventually, and I guess just keep the cream of the crop and whatever. And I remember I also told a family friend, an older woman, about it, and she was saying, oh, you know, as a woman, you'll just end up doing all the clerical work for the other lawyers. And she was actually right. I mean, we're talking like 1973, right? In those days, that's probably true. You know, even if I had gone through law school, I would have ended up doing, you know, grunt work for whoever, you know, as a woman, right? So I got very discouraged and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I ended up majoring in linguistics, which was not studying languages, it was studying language. Now, the thing is, I've always been very good at languages. I mean, you know, I learned French easily. And of course, I was exposed as a Jewish person, you know, Ashkenazi Jew, like, you know, a lot of immigrants in my family when I was a kid. So I kind of by osmosis, I picked up some Yiddish, whatever. And, you know, and I studied Spanish in high school and so forth. And I, you know, so I was very good at languages, but I, you know, I didn't actually want to be a translator. And so I studied the linguistics for a while, but the program at McGill was really bad. And I ended up just dropping out after a year and a half of that. And I just took different jobs. I wanted to get out of the ivory tower and just live my life. You know, I had, you know, come out as a lesbian, a year or two previous. And I just wanted to get out there and live life and work and whatever. And so I did that for quite a number of years. And finally, it got to the point where, you know, I really needed to do something more. Like, it was harder to live a marginal life because the economy had changed. You know, like at that time, she wasn't my wife because we couldn't, you know. But my partner, you know, I had met her, you know, during that time, like when I was about 21, I met her. And we were together, and we were working minimum wage jobs and whatever, and sometimes on welfare, unemployment. But it was getting harder and harder to feed yourself and pay your bills with just living on a marginal income. So we both ended up going back to school. And at first I thought, oh, maybe I'll be a computer programmer, believe it or not. But, you know, that I didn't have a head for that kind of. So my father suggested, look, you know, why don't you talk to this, the head of the translation department at he was working for CN. So at CN, he said, I'll introduce you and just talk to her and see what you think. So that's kind of how it started. I sort of fell into it despite myself because it was something that I could, you know, I took to it. Like, I was, you know, I started the program at Concordia this time because it's a much more flexible place. You can actually work and study, whereas at McGill, they expect you to hang up your life and just full-time study. And, you know, whereas at Concordia, I could go part-time, and it made it much easier for me to do well because I would have more time for each class. Instead of doing six or five courses, I was doing three. So, you know, I was there. So then if I wanted to work or whatever, and in fact, my last year, I did get a job as a translator on contract for a Quebec ministry. So I was working full time my last year, going to school at night. You know, it was exhausting. I mean, but I got my degree. And the thing is, I really found that I did very well with it, you know. And I think had I decided to become a translator when I was 19 or 20, it wouldn't have been the same because, you know, as the chair who interviewed me when I applied for the program, the translation program, said to me, well, we did the interview in French, and I don't know how much French you understand, but I can explain it to you. She said, il faut un certain bagage culturel pour être une bonne traductrice. Right? In other words, you got to have a certain amount of life experience and stuff to be a good translator. And as soon as I took my first introductory course, and, you know, and we did a broad range of stuff. We did literary, technical, this, that, all kinds of translation. And it was towards French and towards English. Like, it was an introduction to everything, right? This teacher, I have to tell you, I credit her as my first mentor to becoming a translator. You know, she really inspired me. I could see that she really loved her profession. You know, she wasn't one of these tenured professors. Like, she was, you know, she was still in the field, and she really inspired me. And I did really well in the class, to my surprise. So it really helped me. And I realized, well, you know, I could actually make a career of this. You know, it's not my dream, but I could have a career that will pay the bills, that will be something I could actually do and do well. And in fact, that's what happened. You know, I did really well in all my classes. I graduated with distinction. Now, by the time I left, jobs were not as easy to come by. So it wasn't like I could go join a translation department because they were in the process of closing them down. Like in all these big companies, they used to have, you know, the Department of Linguistic Services or something. And they were shutting them down left and right because of the economy and whatever, right? I started off doing some freelance work. And then I ended up, actually, one of my teachers who was around my age, because I was a mature student, I was into my 30s at that point, well into my 30s, and she was going away on maternity leave. And she calls me and she says, look, I need somebody to replace me, you know, because I'm going to be on leave like in a month. Do you think you want to give it a shot? And I thought, okay. So I, of course, I had to write an exam. See, that's the other thing. In translation, if they, you know, they're not necessarily going to just interview you and see how you look. Write an exam, right? And then they look at the exam. So if you do really well in the exam, then you have a good chance of getting work. So I did well in the exam. And so she said, okay, you know, and of course she knew me and everything. You know, I was in her class and she knew what I could do. So I worked at CN downtown for about 5 months full time, and I was also still freelancing. So all of a sudden I had I literally worked myself sick. So for a few months there I was exhausted, you know, but I really, you know, but I did really well. And when she came back, the thing is, of course, you know, CN budgets, whatever. So I would have stayed, you know, and I would have done like 2 days. And then the other 3 days, I got another position, like a part-time position elsewhere. It was an umbrella organization for amateur sports federations at the provincial level. And we worked in the Olympic Stadium complex. So I worked there, you know, for about a year and a half or 2 years until they closed my department down. I ended up just being freelance full-time, and there you go.
Yeah.
And how I've been, like, I still do, but now I'm only working about one third time, you know, two thirds retired, one third time.
I wanted to ask you about your roots, because the theme of this year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie is cultivate your roots. So I'm wondering, how have your roots made you the person you are today?
Very much, actually, because I'm Jewish. And so my values and the way I look at the world, and of course, being exposed to more languages, you know, most of us speak more than one language, you know. I mean, I noticed even in the women's and the lesbian community, the English lesbians sort of organized first. And when there were just a few French Francophone women that, you know, I'm talking like the early 70s here, like early to mid 70s. It was the Jewish women, including me, who were kind of like bridges between, you know, like, so if a French woman came in and they couldn't understand, so I would interpret. I would be an interpreter, you know, between stuff like that, you know, and it's sort of kind of pretty standard, you know, I from what I've seen. And just the values, you know, like, I mean, we weren't religious, but, you know, we were very culturally, and it's not just culture, but just values and everything based on traditional Jewish values, you know. It took me a long time to realize that, because, of course, on the religious side, they didn't want lesbians, right? So I didn't join a synagogue or anything when I became an adult, because I figured, well, there's nothing there for me. And I tried to kind of renounce my Judaism. It was like, you know, okay, there's nothing here for me as a lesbian, screw it. But in the end, a lot of Jewish lesbians, especially in the States, started reclaiming. And they kind of brought me back to it, you know, because they were reclaiming things. And I read extensively on that. And I realized, yeah, it's true, you know. Like, that's why I don't fit in a lot of ways, you know, like even to the lesbian community, because my values are so, you know, it's in my blood, you know, it's right in my bone marrow, you know, it just is. So, you know, and we're also, a lot of us, self-taught, you know, especially in the early part of the century, you know, a lot of Jewish people, they had to work, they were immigrants, they couldn't get into universities, there was quotas and all this, but very self-taught, you know, always interested in learning, learning whatever, you know, and that's always been true for me too, and just everything, you know. So for me, it was very, and still is, very influential, you know, my Jewish roots and yeah, learning other languages. And yeah, I'm very into Yiddish now. I wasn't fluent when I was younger, but I've been studying that seriously. I've even done some translation, some literary translation. And so for me, my roots are just completely crucial to everything, you know, including translating. So yeah, for me, like, Yiddish is the language of my heart and my blood and everything, you know. So but I'm grateful that I have the skill to, you know, that I learned French relatively easily compared to a lot of people, and it gave me an opportunity to have a good career here in Quebec, you know. I think that everybody should know at least more than one language, you know, because I really think that's the thing, it broadens your outlook, you know, because, like, French is a different kind of language than English, you know, like, I learned this in school, like, French is a much more analytic language, so everything is, like, broken down, like, just in terms of the physical grammatical structure of a sentence, it's all kind of broken down into its components, whereas English is more like Germanic almost, and Yiddish too, where it's more synthetics, everything's kind of put together.
That was my conversation with Laurie Yaros, a certified translator, a journalist, and a former community radio host. This has been the RVF Franco Podcast 2025. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Catherine Fisher, and I interviewed 8 Canadians for the Franco podcast. In this episode, I spoke with Vanessa Lisabelle, an independent podcaster, journalist, and radio host who lives in the province of Quebec. Here's our conversation.
As a podcaster and radio host, you've interviewed hundreds of Francophone music artists and others in the Franco-Canadian scene. What were some of your most memorable interviews and why?
Well, actually, one was really funny. It's Lisa Leblanc, which is a French singer, and she's so nice. And I was really excited for this interview because I found we had many old CDs, and we had an old demo of Lisa Leblanc, and I handed out to her during the interview, and she was like, "What? There must be like only 20 of them around the world." I know she didn't hand them out in China, you know, but she was like, where did you find that? What is that?" So it's created a moment that was really funny. And this demo was really at the beginning of her music career, so it was funny. So I had another interview with her a few years later, which was like 2 years ago, and she was still nice. I really love the kind of person she is. She's not afraid of who she is, because she can be kind of I don't know if I can say in French, we could say, well, it's not clear. So she's kind of loud. So she has a huge, loud personality, and she's not ashamed, either afraid of that. So I think that's really nice to see, and in interviews, she's really nice. So I had a lot of fun. So I would say Lisa Leblanc was really, really a fun interview.
Does anything else stick out in your mind, any others?
There's also Damien Robitaille, which has been really popular in the, during the pandemic, because he made a lot of videos on the social media. And I've met him, and even though he's really popular, he's seeing people, he's really shy. In an interview, he didn't look at me for the first minutes, and through the interview, he was like, it was friendlier, and I saw we were going somewhere with the interview. And at the end, he was just so calm, and we were like almost becoming friends. He sang to me a song. He sang to his dog when it's time to eat, when it's time to go outside. So I was like, okay, at the beginning of the interview, he was so shy. And at the end, he sang me a song. He sings to his dog. So it was also memorable, and he's also a nice guy. So I would say those two interviews were really memorable. And I could say also like Ingrid Saint-Pierre, which is in her music, she's really, really soft. And her personality is too. And at the interview, she told me, "Okay, I have a secret to tell you. It's the name of my new album coming soon." I was, "Oh my God. Oh, what is it? What is it?" I was so excited. So I would say like many, many interviews like that, we don't know these people. We know them as fans, as journalists and interviewers, and they're used to it. They always have the same questions. But after a few minutes, when you ask them more questions about their projects, it feels more like a friendly conversation, speaking to someone you haven't seen from long ago. So I love that. And a lot of people I met, it turns out to be like the interview was like if two friends were speaking about something. So that was the feeling I was looking for. And a lot of these artists just went into it.
What music artists are on your personal playlist these days?
Well, because I'm working in a radio station, I would say it changes like every day. I listen to a lot of music, as I will listen to like newer music, as the Anglophone classics, and we would say like Lady Gaga. I love like Dua Lipa, all those person, but I also like Laurence Nerbonne, which is French Quebecer music producer and singer, and she's amazing for what she's doing. But also I listen to older music. I like Dalida. I like also that's not that old, but Amy Winehouse too. So I'm right now, it would be hard to say, because
it's all
sometimes there's a new, sometimes there is a new song, and I'm like, "Oh my God, this is my favorite music right now." So yeah.
So what brought you into radio, and what has kept you there?
Before going studying in a radio, I was studying in graphic design, and because I'm kind of person with a lot of imagination, creativity also, but I talk a lot. And in graphic design, it was fun, but you only talk with like your client and a bit of your coworker too, but it's a lot of a job. You're behind a computer and you do your stuff. That's it. So I was looking for something more with more touch, let's say it right, like that. And then I decided to go to that school. It was a whole year, and it's been like 10 years. This year it's been 10 years, and I fell in love with this, with radio, because at first week of class, I was like, oh, damn, this is amazing. I love that. The people are nice. We have to speak, but not only speak, talk about what we love, what we think, but listen to others also to have discussion with them. So this was amazing. And I first started in a radio station, which was 7 hours from home. It was my first away from mom. So this was really scary. It was a tough year, but it was like the moment I turned into a real adult, to adult life. And then I was like, okay, so I've break the ice. It's time to go with other projects with radio. I'm ready. So since then, I love this. And the interviews, this is what I love the most. And yeah, so this is, I didn't expect to be that long in radio, 10 years. It feels like me, it was like 2 years ago I finished school in radio, that I've met so many people in 10 years and I still love it. And also to, this is not what I thought at the beginning, but now what I love is all these people I met. And because of the radio, a lot of people I know I left after a few years because it's not something that you are paid a lot, but it's as we say in French, métier de passion. So we have to be really passionate. And what I love is, so all the people I've met through the years, and if it hasn't been the radio, I would have been aware of what's going on with the francophones, with the Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, because I'm from Quebec. So, well, I'm in my little world with the francophone majority, so I wasn't that aware of what's going on. And with the radio, with the jobs I had, I've met people from around Canada that were telling me what is really going on, what is their reality. So this is what I love right now and what I didn't expect the first years. And this is because of radio, because I met people, I heard a lot of stories in reality linked to the situation of Francophone in Canada. So this is something I love about that.
As you know, the theme of this year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie is cultivate your roots. How have your roots made you the person that you are today?
Mm-hmm. Well, would be at first, I would say like my mom. Everything I know now, a lot of the things I know now is because of her. And I'm grateful for that. But I would say like my roots are also coming from all the, I'm going back to this, but all the people I've met. So all these people that share me, their story, their reality, even though it's not part of my story, my life, it's been part of what I'm today, what I think about this or that, being aware of this or that. So I think my root is based on many, many people.
So, Vanessa, you live in Quebec in a Francophone majority. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about the Francophonie in that context?
Yeah, I would say at first, as I told earlier, that I've been aware only a few years ago of what is going on with the Francophonie around Canada, because as a lot of people see Quebec, it's like we're kind of in a castle with high walls, and thinking about kind of me, myself, and I, because we're like, oh, we live in French, it's safe, and suddenly some people in Quebec become aggressive about English. So I would say first thing about Francophonie as who I am living in Quebec, Francophonie is beautiful. And this is why I'm sad when I see so many people, maybe not around me, but in Quebec, that are so aggressive when they see English somewhere and they say, like, the joke is, on parle en français ici, en français s'il vous plaît. And I understand these people that they may be afraid that English take over. But what I see and why I say Francophonie is beautiful is that outside of Quebec, like Saint-Boniface in Winnipeg, when you see the French community, they are not like, oh, English is bad, you shouldn't speak English, here it's French. They say, kind of say, look at us, look at how French is beautiful, look at what we do, like, look how our community is strong, even though we're a small community. But how, look how we're fun. So they do activities, festivals, events, happenings. And this is how it should be done here in Quebec too. So instead of being like aggressive, saying, oh, English is bad, don't speak English, here is French, is look at what we're doing. Look, we're having fun, we're doing, we have wonderful artists, we have wonderful projects, cultural projects. So this is something that makes me sad, because outside of Quebec, I know there are some English people I've met that think that we are kind of, you know, mad about them. And even some, I've met some English students studying in French. They have immersive class and they are scared to speak French because some French people are aggressive to them. Oh, this is not a good French you're speaking. So this is scary for them. So yeah, this is what I think. So Francophonie is beautiful, but I think some French community do it better than others by making Francophonie looking great, amazing, and being proud of this. So this is what I think about it.
That was my conversation with Vanessa Lisabel, an independent podcaster, journalist, and radio host who lives in the province of Quebec. This has been the RVF Franco Podcast 2025. Thanks for tuning in.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Jessica Walowicz's newest single, This Is It. While her first two releases lean into soft folk, This Is It pumps the brakes and takes a hard turn into synth pop. The track marks Jessica's second collaboration with producer Jonas Bonetta and was released on February 28th. Stay tuned to hear more from Jessica Walowicz during her upcoming CFRC Airwave YGK Musician Residency in the coming weeks. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via Visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, please enjoy This Is It by Jessica Walowicz on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us now, right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Every week, yet I haven't. They shot a movie once in my hometown. Everybody was in it for miles around.
Enchanté, bonjour. Ladies and gentlemen, that was some beautiful French, and welcome back to another episode of Plugged in My Ears. Weird start, I know, but that's because weird things are happening in the NHL. I don't even know where to begin. So many bizarre trades, weird occurrences. And maybe because there's a lot of trades that occurred, we can leave those to the side just for the beginning. Because I just want to talk about one thing that's kind of weird. Aaron Ekblad, PED, suspension, 20 games. I mean, I don't really know what to think of that. What do you guys think?
I don't believe they've released more information on it. It says, okay, this is his statement. He says, ultimately, I made a mistake by taking something to help me recover from a recent injury without first checking with proper medical team and personnel. Okay. I have let my teammates, the Panther organization, down and our great fans down. For that, I'm truly sorry. So it sounds like he says he took some sort of unauthorized medication that got flagged when he took a PED test, but...
Yeah, what do you think, Adam?
I kind of believe it, but
I think that's what they all say.
Yeah.
That's the most popular auto-generated response to getting confronted about taking PEDs. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was an accident. Aaron Ekblad seems like a pretty stand-up guy. Doesn't really seem to cause too many issues. Maybe Marchand's already having a negative impact over there in Florida, but no, I'm just kidding. I'm sure this has been going on for a while, but yeah, I mean, Florida's pretty well set. I think they're honestly the most loaded team in the NHL now.
Yeah.
After this trade deadline, so I think they're going to be just fine, and they're going to get them back and rested for the playoffs. So, shot Ekblad down for a little bit, cruise into the playoffs.
Do you think Matthew is going to be back for playoffs?
By Matthew Tkachuk.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't remember what they said originally, but my guess is that they will find a way to get him back. Because you got to remember, though, these guys are so driven to play. I mean, if I was him, why would I? Like, if I could and risk injuring myself, I probably would risk injuring myself to go back a bit early.
Yeah.
Which is, I know that sounds stupid to say, but you don't want to blow an opportunity when your team's this good. And as Adam mentioned, Brad Marchand being there now, like, what's better than one rat, two rats? It's two more than you could possibly have on your team anyways. There's the only two rats left in the NHL who can still do stuff with the puck. So my guess is that he'll be ready for playoffs. He'll find a way. But he won't be healed. I'll put it that way.
What I'm going off is that his, like, Brady in the Four Nations was, like, quoted saying that if Matthew is sitting out this game against Canada, like, or at least the last two periods, it must be something really bad, because I know him and he doesn't sit out games no matter what.
Yeah, I think that further corroborates the point that he'll likely be back
for playoffs. Oh, yeah, but I also think that makes the injury sound pretty bad if he's, if his brother's saying it must be something really serious if he's sitting out, so I don't know. Not really clear what it is exactly, but I think he's fairly injured, to say the least.
What do you think, Adam?
I mean, I think he's going to be fine. I think he's going to come back. I think they're going to probably have a pretty easy first round playoff series. I think it's going to be either, I mean, right now Washington's got the one seed and they have the two seed. So I think it'll probably be Columbus, maybe Detroit, Ottawa, one of those teams. I think it's going to be a pretty easy way for them to get going. So maybe they bring him back like later in that series. Maybe he doesn't start the series. Mm-hmm. But I do think he will be back. I think he will play in the playoffs. I mean, they want to go back-to-back, right? So, I mean...
And they would be the first team to do that since Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, he's going to be there to do that. So, I think that, I can't see Florida winning the cup without him, is the way that I put it.
That's a good point, but I do think, and I think I agree with you, I think they could probably get by the first round without him.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think they can definitely get by the first round without him, but...
Second might be a bit more complicated, but it also depends on what happens, too.
Yeah, because in the second round, you're going to end up probably having to play either Toronto or Tampa.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
Both are not easy.
Yeah, I mean, I should clarify, you're probably going to end up having to play Tampa. but no, I'm just kidding.
Toronto's past their ways of
losing in the first round, I swear.
Yeah, they say that every year, but yet...
Tampa looks good this year, though. I don't know.
They do look good, but the golf courses, specifically the ones around Toronto, already have a lot of time slots booked off.
Well, speaking of the Leafs, they're in a really interesting situation. I mean, we predicted this a while ago, right? Where they would have this kind of situation with Marner that
they just can't afford him straight up, but they really still want to keep him, and he wants to stay. But there's just no way a team that's a contender is going to pay him $14 million by eight is like whatever he's asking. I think that's about what he's asking. He's asking for $104 million for an eight-year contract.
Not a chance.
It's not going to happen on Toronto, and I don't think it would actually happen on any other team that wants a chance at winning the Cup. It would maybe happen on a bottom-rung team. Like, I could see
Chicago.
Blackhawks giving him that.
Or San Jose, maybe.
But, man, would it... I mean, okay, Blackhawks wouldn't be that bad to play for, but, like, going from playing for Toronto to San Jose would be a bit of a shock to the system, to say the least.
Yeah, it would. But then again, Marner's, what, fifth in the league for points right now?
He's good.
He's got a lot of stuff back in him. Like, the only four people in front of him are McDavid, McKinnon, Dreisaitl, and Kucherov.
To be honest, I think
the captain who gets paid more than him has got less points.
I think the reason why Marner's points surged a bit this year is I think he got way more like central play just because Matthews had so much time out with injuries and stuff.
Yeah, Matthews isn't 100% even now. Like,
well, he's on a, what, 14-game point streak or something?
I know, that's probably... That's insane.
It is very good.
He is that good. Yeah. It's pretty clear that he's still not fully recovered from that injury, because that injury that he had, they never really reported how bad it was, but it definitely, he came back probably a little too quick. Like looking long term. Obviously, it's not affecting his play now because he's playing so well, but I would not be surprised if he goes down with an injury, because all it takes is one hit, right?
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. And it doesn't even have to be a big hit either. It can just be a hit the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, anyway, so they're definitely in a weird spot, and my guess would be, they do not want to put him to free agency. That would be, that's kind of spooky for them, but I don't know.
Sure they can come to an agreement. I mean, Marner's a huge Toronto guy, is he not? He grew up in Toronto his whole life. His favorite team were the Maple Leafs.
I think the issue is there's just no, like, I don't think he, like, will let himself take a low deal that they're going to offer him. Like, I don't even know, like, do you think they could even afford $10 million for him?
No, I actually don't think they could. Well, it depends on what they want to do. The thing is, if Toronto has no issue having a terrible defensive core and paying guys very little money and not getting good defensemen, then yeah, they can keep them, but they're going to suffer from it. Mm-hmm. The question is, what do they prefer? Do they prefer overall decent play, or do they prefer supreme offensive dominance and horrific defensive capabilities? Mm-hmm. And I don't know what Toronto prefers, because in their history, they've often chosen the latter, not the former. But that can change, right? It all depends. I forget who's the GM on Toronto right now. Who is the GM?
Trevling?
Is it? Trevling? I don't remember.
Yeah, double check that.
But anyways, like, so much is going to depend on what type of GM they are. It's too bad I can't remember who it is right now. But anyways, like, that's what it's going to come down to. I don't, like, to me, at least, the management...
Yeah, it's Brad Trevling.
Yeah, and Brad Trevling is a pretty... Like, he never really favored supreme offensive power overall capacity and ability to be good. So my guess is that if Marner can't go for something less than $10 million, he probably will end up in Toronto. Because who does Toronto have on defense that's really that good?
I didn't even realize, apparently, on Sportsnet, they said that apparently the Hurricanes tried to pitch to Toronto that they would swap Rantanen for Marner.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a lose-lose, because they can't afford Rantanen either. So, I mean,
I don't know what, like, I was saying before we were on air, like, I don't know what, like, what is happening in the management in the, like, Hurricanes department there, but they have completely lost it. They're never going to win with this kind of management going on there, so I have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, but I mean, they're still having a pretty good year. I wouldn't be surprised if they make it past the first round this year.
Oh, yeah, but they had an opportunity to have an excellent year, like, go all the way, I would say, but they've basically squandered that, so I don't understand.
It'll be interesting to see. I really liked Marty Nietzsche, so that was, like...
That was a silly, silly trade.
...go from Carolina. But yeah, no, for those who don't know, Rantanen got traded to the Dallas Stars. That strengthens them a lot too, and Dallas was one of the teams I was really high on at the beginning of the year. But yeah, I think Dallas, Florida Stanley Cup Final.
I think I'm not fully sold on Dallas yet. I want to see a bit more from them. I after watching them in the playoffs last year, they looked really good. Don't get me wrong, But I feel like one of the, I was saying this before, one of the biggest factors was Chris Tanev. I swear to God, the guy that is doesn't get that many points regular season, just a defenseman, really good defensive defenseman. He was legitimately the difference between them getting blown up by the Oilers and not. He was just so, so good.
Yeah.
That being said, I mean, they had this season they've had some weird stuff. I know Jason Robertson kind of was really stone cold at the start of the season. I think he's picked it up a bit now.
Mm-hmm. He's a pretty good player, though, I got to say that. When you give that guy the puck and any amount of time and space, he will be so good.
He's really good.
Like, yeah. I think he's pretty underrated, actually, which is kind of crazy to say because he's paid pretty well for what he does.
Yeah. No, anyways, I think if Rantanen really clicks and like they get out of him what they want, I think I could see them being very much a contender. If that... They're kind of still in this weird offensive funk. I don't know. They might have some problems in the playoffs, but
that's a good point. Yeah.
But you know, if they pull it together and they're really like, you know, like clearly meshing, then I could see them being like a major contender for sure. Mm-hmm. I still think that the West is quite strong though.
Yeah, at the top, but not at the bottom of the league. Yeah, yeah, their top teams, which are the teams that are going to play in the playoffs, are extremely good. So you're right. Actually, I guess that's all that really matters.
I think the Avalanche are still really good. I mean, that Nate's just trade's looking quite good.
They're still really good. Yeah, fantastic. Doesn't even...
Well, I'm saying they lost Rantanen, like, you know, and it doesn't seem like they've lost any steam there.
No, not at all. I honestly think this is really exposing Rantanen a little bit. I know you can't really tell much from 13 games in Carolina, and apparently he was unhappy. But the fact that Colorado hasn't slowed down since losing him...
Yeah. They just skip a beat now.
Yeah, that kind of just shows that maybe he wasn't... You know,
yeah. I just mean his stock is plummeting. I mean, I'm clearly Dallas was able to wanted to pay him for what they paid him, but
yeah. Is he requesting a trade again though?
No,
he can't move.
He just signed long term with Dallas. Okay, yeah.
No, he's not moving.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know why I thought I heard that. I must have just been confused. But
no. And then another question: are we sold on the Jets? You think that? Do you guys believe in the Jet system? I don't know.
What do you mean by Jets system? Are you talking about management system here with what they're doing?
No, I'm just saying their team. Like, do you think that they've got what it takes right now?
I mean, that's a tough question. Okay, look, I think the Jets are a really solid team, and they have what I would describe as the best goalie in the NHL at the moment. I don't even think that's a question.
Yep.
And I also think that Scheifele is pretty underrated. Mm-hmm. Kyle Connor is pretty insane as well. Morrissey's pretty good. And they don't really have a bad player. So that's what's great about that. That means they're going to make a deep playoff run, but you kind of need like a, you know, not a Connor McDavid per se, but like, I don't know. You just need a goal scorer that's more offensively inclined than Scheifele and Kyle Connor. Those guys do score a lot of goals, so maybe I shouldn't be so critical.
They did go out and acquire known goal scorer Luke Shen at the trade deadline. So.
Oh, true. So, yeah, no, maybe that does.
That was a joke. Luke Shen doesn't score that much.
No, but you're right, though. They, like, yeah. Actually, I just don't know what I'm talking about. I think that's what that really shows, but...
I mean, let's look at the power play ratings.
I didn't even question that. But just briefly for a second, though.
I'm Brandon Tanev.
You know what?
Yeah.
I'm liking this. I'm liking what I'm seeing from the Jets because my biggest criticism of them before was their power play. I just thought they just didn't have that extra kind of factor there and the special teams just weren't there for them. But right now, they have the best power play in the league by a decent margin. So... You know what? I think that's pretty promising. I'd say that they're going to go further this year than they did last year. I could see that for sure.
Yeah, I could see that. Where's Montreal on that?
Oh, the CEO of the Winnipeg Jets is a smart guy too.
Oh, 17th, so, brutal
on the power rankings.
No, in the
Hurricanes
power play.
At 25.
Where are the Sens? 14. It's pretty good. I saw Chicago was up there 7th.
Penguins at 9. Interesting.
Hmm.
Blackhawks at 7. That's a testament to Bedard, for sure.
Maybe they just don't go on the power play that often.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's true, too.
Devils are strong. Wings are strong, yeah. No, those make sense. I'm really surprised how the Jets is a power play at 31.6. That's pretty strong.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I just had one question because I just popped up in my feed and reminded me of it. But what did you think about Josh Allen's re-signing?
Oh, I thought it was huge. I think he's definitely worth the money. I mean,
how much was it again? Because it says it in euros here, but
I think it's like $350 million.
Yeah, for how many years again is that?
Five or 6 years.
That's crazy. So, like 50.
6 years, $330 million with $250 million guaranteed.
So what is the rest bonuses?
The rest would be like if he doesn't fill it out if he doesn't play like to the end of his contract.
Say he retires or gets injured or something like that,
or he gets traded.
In which case, what happens if he gets traded?
The other team would pay it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he's... I like that like it a lot. I mean, it's kind of hard to argue against him. He is the best player in the NFL after last season. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, you got to pay him the big boy bucks if you want to keep big boys around like that. So,
how much are other quarterbacks getting paid in comparison? Is he the highest paid quarterback now?
I think that does make him the highest paid quarterback in the NFL. I don't know for sure what the next closest is, but I do know that there was a, I forget who was up there, but I know Mahomes wasn't up there. I know Lamar is up there, but yeah, I don't know. I think he's definitely top two in the NFL in contract now. So, oh yeah, Dak is first. Dak Prescott is first. Yeah, with $60 million a year.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah,
that's crazy. So how much the average bimbo getting paid in the NFL though? Like, say
the average salary in the NFL?
Yeah,
that's actually interesting.
I'm only saying that because obviously, like, practice squad guys aren't getting that much, and they're technically NFL players. No.
The average is $2.7 million a year.
Which is higher than the NHL, isn't it? The NHL's average is, what, 1.5 or something like that? Or maybe it's probably gone up now, actually.
That's interesting that it averages out to be that low.
The average NHL salary is $3.4 million.
Whoa.
But smaller rosters.
A lot more players in the NFL.
Yeah.
I know. I'm just still surprised because there's such a big contract in the NFL.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of parity. And also, I think you have to be really cautious when it comes to injuries in the NFL, too. Mm. When in the NHL, I feel like you can be a little less cautious because players seem to be...
I guess you're right.
Tougher.
But I would have even thought that the minimum signing contract was pretty high.
For the NFL?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm pretty sure they can get away with like having guys on the practice squad for like $50,000 a year.
It's kind of a loophole.
Yeah. So I think they can really lower that average salary down a little bit. But I think NFL definitely has the most lucrative contracts. Maybe actually baseball.
MLB's got to be there.
Yeah. How does the MLB make so much money, though? I know they play tons of games. Yeah, twice the games, but don't they usually not have great viewership?
No, pretty good.
They consistently have like dominant viewership, really.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not as good as it used to be,
mm-hmm.
but they still bring in a lot of viewers, and they're also very, very present in like the Dominican Republic, Korea, Japan, mm-hmm. It's a global game at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And the stadium system they've got going on is pretty smart. Like the way they run it, like I think that they do well off of those. They have those like deals, like kind of hot dog day or something, and they usually make them convenient. Yeah. So a lot of people go to the games. Like,
yeah, they do. I mean, going to a game is so much more enjoyable than watching it on TV.
I would agree with that.
I mean, I would never turn down like a free ticket to a baseball game. So,
you know, I've only ever been to one, actually. It was in Detroit, and there was one home run, and it was on the very first swing of the game.
Oh, that's right.
I feel bad. Yeah. I've never been to Ottawa as a pro team. I've never been to
it. I've been, actually. It's not bad to watch. Yeah. The guys are nice. You can chat to them from the dugout. They'll talk back to you because there's usually not that many people in the crowd.
Like it's
really funny.
It's
really
funny. Yeah. Like,
and it's just outside of Canadian Tire, too.
Oh,
so
yeah?
if they ring one too far, it goes in the parking lot. The Canadian Tire just reams someone's car.
And it's right next to the highway.
Yeah.
Is it a pro team?
Yeah, it's not. Well, yeah, it's pro, but it's like below AAA, whatever the league
double
is below.
A?
Is that what it's called? Double A? I don't know what it's called. I thought it had a different name.
Do you know what they're called?
No.
I think they actually changed their name recently. Maybe.
Yeah, they did. Although I did apply to be a free intern.
Yeah.
I did apply to be an unpaid intern there, and I got rejected.
Rejected?
Yeah. All I wanted to do was be in charge of like season ticket holders and walk them around, get them stuff. I guess I didn't cut it for that. But you know what? It's actually really fun to watch, though, because they'll come up to you and they'll be like, hey, like if I throw you a ball, will you throw it back? Otherwise, I have to pay for the ball that we don't get back because they don't make enough money. It's fun to watch. And people are really enthusiastic. You can really easily sneak in your own bottle of water and can of water if you want, which is nice, too, so you don't have to pay for water at the stadium.
That's really nice of them.
Yeah. No, it's cool. It's cool, actually.
No, it's interesting. I mean, yeah.
There used to be a AAA team that played there some time ago. I just don't think there's a big viewership. I mean, Ottawa's such a hockey city, though. It's difficult to sell out.
I don't think they play that many games.
I don't know how many they play, but I just know that they get less viewership than the GG's men's hockey team does. And even those guys don't get a lot.
They play 96 games total.
Whoa.
At home or throughout the whole year?
Throughout the whole year.
There's a lot of teams, too. Yeah, okay.
That's a decent proportion. Sizable.
Yeah.
Very sizable. 48 home games a year. That's a lot.
There's actually the only three Canadian teams are in Eastern, I guess.
Is it Ottawa?
Eastern Ontario and Western Quebec.
Is that Ottawa, Montreal?
No, Ottawa, Quebec, and Trois-Rivières.
Oh, Trois-Rivières has a team.
Yeah.
Interesting. I guess that makes sense, actually. I did hear that that was a pretty big baseball area. But what's that league called, though? Is it called Double A?
It's called the Frontier League. So it's still a professional league, but it's not associated. It's an independent baseball league.
So at least all I know about the league is that a lot of those guys are from down south.
Yeah, so it's kind of unique. I have to say that the stadium in Ottawa is hilarious because there's something about it. It does not feel like it's in Ottawa.
Yeah, it feels like you're somewhere else. I don't know how to explain that.
It feels like you're in like the States.
They have like little. There's a big parking lot right next to it. And there's kind of like a tailgate sort of thing going on.
Yeah, cool.
I don't know. It's very unique for Ottawa sports.
It feels like you're kind of in the outskirts of like a random American city.
I guess you know what though. I think it's because a lot of Americans are watching it. I think that's probably why.
Yeah, I'd say the whole expat community goes to those games.
There's tons of Americans that would be watching this. Yeah, that makes sense. All right.
Yeah.
It says it's comparable to single A level.
Yeah. Okay.
So.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Well, yeah, that's what when I was talking to one of the players, he said a lot of those guys try and move on to the associate or the higher leagues from that league.
Okay.
So to me, in my head, he was describing it like the OHL, but I don't know if that's accurate.
I think it's open to all ages would be the major difference.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of skill.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But, one thing I remember hearing about baseball is it, and I don't know if this is true, Adam, but like baseball apparently has become like a total. Like, I mean, a lot of sports have become really like. You know, scouts are looking at these advanced analytics like really thoroughly. Mm-hmm. But I heard baseball is like really big on that now. Like the advanced analytics, like they care so much about those. Like it matters everything if you want to get drafted or not.
Yeah, baseball set the tone really for almost all analytics based like scouting. I mean, it's classic. Like you talk about the movie Moneyball. Mm-hmm. Like that was just all like that was very basic analytics, and it's expanded so much since then. Yeah. And it has been. It's really affected the way that they draft pitchers specifically, because pitchers you can tell a lot from a pitcher's velocity that they have in their pitch, the different kinds of pitches they have, like the amount of times they throw certain pitches. It's really interesting to take a look at. I know I really enjoy playing the MLB The Show game on the PlayStation, and even in the game they have so many advanced analytics like going on into if you're doing like a franchise mode or something, you can like look at these like crazy advanced stats when you're making a decision. It doesn't matter because it's a video game, but like, it's still cool to see that realism in the game.
Yeah, that's cool.
Baseball definitely I would say has the most, and I think honestly probably the easiest to calculate because it's so. What's the best way to describe baseball? It's so, like, it's a lot of the same going on. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of robotic.
Uh-huh.
It's not like where there's, like, with the NHL, like, it's hard to measure, like, fast break attempts and stuff like that. Or it's hard
there's
to measure,
randomness
like,
to the
yeah,
NHL,
yeah, like. There's less randomness in baseball. Like it's more predictable.
You're always going to be at bat, and you're always going to be pitching in the same way. Like,
exactly, yeah. It's pretty predictable, I'd say. And I think that makes it easier to have all these stats. But, I mean, they found ways to do it in a lot of other sports too. I know NFL is really big on that now. So they
the betting companies. What are they?
Honestly,
what are
that's actually a very
the
fair
companies
point.
Is what generate all the stats because they it matters so much for them to have the best stats on everything to make the best margins and set up their systems basically to make the most money.
Yeah.
So they generate so much statistics for the betting apps.
I didn't realize that the NFL was like huge into that too. But what type of statistics do they care a lot about? Like your acceleration. And
I mean, I think it's just kind of like anything that you wouldn't necessarily like notice with the eye, like the statistics that add, I think the biggest difference is things that add up over a long time.
Okay.
Like consistency statistics and like a lot of other things like that, like that are just not what you would notice right away. I mean, I was saying for the NHL, like things that you wouldn't notice right away is like that Elias Pettersson's shot has been consistently lower this season. Like that's just like you wouldn't really notice that right away.
Yeah.
Or that he has not reached the same top speed this year as last year. Like, you wouldn't notice.
I think the main thing for a lot of the sports is speed, honestly, because like every sport seems to be getting faster.
Yeah,
maybe not basketball. Basketball seems
to be they're slowing. Yeah. Slowing down.
Yeah, I mean, basketball's in an interesting state right now. I think honestly, the NBA is the least exciting sport to watch, and like I think I'd rather watch NASCAR over the NBA.
Oh, for sure.
Really?
I think the problem is. I've had this sentiment towards the NBA for like some time now, and I think it's only now gotten to the point where like I never had an extreme attraction to the NBA anyways, so it was like it was already like kind of not interesting enough for me necessarily right off the bat,
right?
But now it's gotten to the point where they're actually starting to alienate, like, way more people that are actual basketball fans.
Yeah.
Which is a major problem.
You know, I think the players are paid too much.
In the NBA?
Yeah,
I agree.
For sure. And, like, they are just, they don't have to live up to anything in their contract. There's no accountability from players that are, like, solidified NBA stars.
Uh-huh.
Oh, like, the ones that are, like, trying to make the league, that's, like, the most exciting stuff. I mean, we've got March Madness coming up in a couple weeks.
That's so fun.
I think
to
that's
watch.
The most exciting basketball to watch because those guys actually care when they go out there.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And basketball can be interesting. That's my qualm with it, is that it can be super interesting and fun to watch. Mm-hmm. It just often isn't because it just doesn't have the right mindset in it. And I think the Four Nations, if it prove anything, is that when there's two teams that actually really care about the game, it's going to make it a lot better for fans to watch, right? Like, it's it's possible to watch a game where people actually aren't trying.
On the topic of March Madness, though, who's projected to win? Like, who's number one in the country at the moment?
I don't know who's number one in the country. I'll have to bring that up. But I do know Duke is very high up this year. They have, like, the number one draft prospect, Cooper Flagg.
Yeah, I've heard that he's supposed to be quite good.
But he might not even go to the NBA draft because he might stick around and play another year with Duke.
Why would, what was the incentive for him to do that?
Well, he's getting paid so much through NIL right now.
Oh, okay.
And, like,
there's no point.
There's not really too much of a point for him to go play for a crappy NBA team.
Yeah,
it's good. When he could play for Duke and win, like, another national tournament.
It's interesting how now that they make more money, they can make more money playing in the NCAA, right?
Yeah, they can make more money playing in the NCAA. Auburn is the number one team in the nation right now, but Duke is second.
Okay.
So
where's Clemson? They're just always pretty good. That's why I ask.
Clemson's 11th.
Really? So
yeah.
But isn't that kind of bad for them, though, on average? Like, aren't they usually top 10?
Mainly, I would say Clemson's more of a football school, but, I mean,
I thought they were supposed to be excellent for basketball, too.
I would say they're an overall good athlete school, but I would say they're mainly known for football compared to basketball. But, yeah, actually, I was kind of surprised that Clemson's this high.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess. Well, to be fair, I really don't know my NCAA basketball.
Yeah. It's a bunch of good teams. I think it's going to be a really good March Madness, actually. We've got 5 days until the bracket gets released, so that will be really interesting to see. But yeah.
Yeah.
We've got an interesting time in sports coming up. I'm really excited for the NHL, like the last few weeks of the NHL. I think it's going to be really exciting. I think we've got some pretty cool playoff races coming up.
It's tight again, so it's going to be like last year's down to the wire.
Yeah, and it's also a lot more interesting when your team's involved, too. So
that's true.
I hope Montreal keeps on winning.
And I don't know. I guess it's either Ottawa or Montreal, right? It's kind of one or the other.
Well, right now it's like Ottawa, Montreal, Detroit's lost 5 in a row, so Detroit's there, too. Boston's technically there, but they've played 2 more games than Montreal and Ottawa. The Rangers are there, but they just got blown out by the Blue Jackets. The Blue Jackets are there.
If you've watched the Rangers, man, like they've looked so weak on a lot of aspects of their game, and I think it's the offense for me that's just been so bad on them. Like,
I agree. They have way too much offensive talent to be doing what they're doing. It's actually unacceptable.
The issue is that, as I said, Chris Kreider is not a guy that makes plays. He's a guy that tips in the puck, and when the other guys aren't skating a puck around and getting good shots on net, he's not going to be a factor. And I think Mika Zibanejad has been having some issues. That's definitely not helping. But I mean, Panarin's signed a big contract. Like, this guy is, you know, supposed to be producing a bit more. I think they lost some depth, and that kind of hurt them. But yeah, I don't know. They're in a weird spot. I'd say Vincent Trocheck's been the most solid.